Hello, and welcome to The Reading Life, WWNO's weekly look at the New Orleans literary scene. I'm Susan Larson. This week, we'll be talking with biographer and memoirist Rich Cohen, whose new book is The Fish That Ate the Whale, The Life and Times of America's Banana King, about New Orleanian Sam Zamuri. And we'll hear Fred Kasten's Sound of Books interview with Steve Call, author of Private Empire, ExxonMobil, and American Power. Rich Cohen is an amazing writer. He writes about celebrities for Vanity Fair and Rolling Stone, everyone from Keith Richard to Angelina Jolie. And in his books, such wonderful bestsellers as Tough Jews and Sweet and Low, he brings Jewish Americans to life. In his most recent, The Fish That Ate the Whale, The Life and Times of America's Banana King, he tells the story of a very prominent New Orleanian, Samuel Zamuri, who lived from 1877 to 1961 and who ran the megacorporation United Fruit for more than 25 years. Welcome to The Reading Life, Rich.
Thanks for having me.
I love this book. I read it the first day I got it, and I read it again yesterday, and I loved it even more. And the seeds of this book were planted a long time ago when you were a sophomore at Tulane, right?
Yep. I had a great teacher at Tulane named Joseph Cohen, who actually taught a class called Jewish American Novel. And for some reason, he started the class with a long story about Sam Zamuri, who we knew about because, first of all, a bunch of the buildings in Tulane were named after him. You might live in Zamuri Dorm. One of the dorms is named after his daughter, Doris, and the president's house of Tulane had been Zamuri's house. But while we knew about him, we really knew nothing about him in detail, and Joseph Cohen told me the story of this amazing guy who came from Russia and sort of lived every facet of the American dream, the best of it and the worst of it, and it sort of planted a seed in me that I've sort of been following ever since.
His legacy is written so large in our city, but he's not quite a household name. How do you explain that?
You know, some people say, well, how important can this guy be? I haven't heard of him. And I'm saying he was so important that you haven't heard of him. You know, he had an immigrant's idea, which is you don't want to draw the wrong kind of attention. And as a Jewish immigrant, being in the paper was like being in trouble.
Mm-hmm.
You just didn't want people to know what you were doing. And especially some of the stuff that Samuel Zamuri was involved in wasn't great stuff. You know, he went down to Honduras with a group of mercenary soldiers that he had recruited from the bar at the Hotel Monteleone. Guys like Lee Christmas and Machine Gun Maloney, who later became one of the head of New Orleans police. And they overthrew the government of Honduras to sort of set the conditions for Zamuri's business. So that's not necessarily the thing you want written about in the Picayune.
I know, and once you read this book, you'll never look at the carousel bar quite the same way again. He became such a key player in Central American politics. How did he become a man who, with a single phone call, could change the course of what happened in Latin America?
Well, he set up in Honduras. So he was in Honduras and New Orleans, primarily, and he built this incredible company called Calumel Fruit. And right across the border in Guatemala was United Fruit, which was a Boston company. And they went to war. And United Fruit was huge. It was like the biggest company in the world, and Calumel was small. And ultimately, Zamuri defeated United Fruit. And the New York Times called him the fish that swallowed the whale, where the title comes from the book. And that put him basically as the primary business, taxpayer, everything, in just about every country in South America. He was it. More powerful than the government. I mean, the road in Guatemala, if you wanted to drive the Pacific Ocean, you had to drive down a private United Fruit road. They owned the ports. They delivered the mail. So if they got pissed off at the government, they just stopped the mail. And
wow.
That meant that he had sort of a cudgel over every country where bananas were grown. He could shut the country down. Of course, the backlash of that, eventually you get Che Guevara and Fidel Castro.
Right. I mean, I love that long arc of history that you draw in this book. And as a businessman, he was such a modern one, in a way. He was one of the early modern tycoons, don't you think?
Yeah, he was brilliant. His whole business was based on such a simple idea, which is he went to Mobile to buy his own bananas because he'd seen some bananas on a push cart in Selma, Alabama, where he lived. And he saw that the big fruit companies would go through the bananas, and they took what looked to him like completely good bananas and threw them in this big pile. And he said, "What are those?" And they said, "Those are the ripe." They said, "What's that?" They said, "Any banana that has more than one freckle You could never get it to the market on time, and we throw them out. So literally, this was one man's trash. It's another man's treasure. He bought the rights for almost nothing that everybody else considered garbage, based on the idea that if he hustled enough, he could actually make it to the market. And just doing that, starting with nothing, he had $100,000 by the time he was 18 years old, and that was in the 1890s. Be like $1 million today.
And I love that scene of him in the boxcar with the bananas getting riper by the second, racing
right.
against time.
I mean, very cinematic. What a great salesman that would make you.
Uh-huh.
You know, it's sort of like if you're 6 hours slow in making your sale, you're done.
Right. But the other things about him that struck me was that he was international early on. He was so well traveled. He used public relations.
Right. Well, first of all, now we have the global economy and everything's global. This was really one of the first real global companies,
mm-hmm.
United Fruit and Coimel Fruit, because you sell more bananas in this country than Apple.
Wow.
Not a single banana that you buy is grown here. It's 100% import. So that meant that it was a country that was everywhere and nowhere. And a huge problem that they had was ultimately their reputation, and that's where the public relations came in. And he hired this guy, Edward Bernays, who actually made up the word public relations. Before that, you'd have press agents. He made it sort of real, professional. And one of the amazing things they did was run this campaign to basically convince Americans that Guatemala had gone communist in 1954 when it had not. And the result was a U.S. basically CIA overthrow of Jacobo Arbenz in Guatemala. So there's your public relations at work.
And he was so fearless, Sam Zemuri was. He seemed not afraid to be his own government in a way. Do you think he ever had a moment of self-doubt?
You know, he must have. I mean, I know that his son was one of the first casualties in the Second World War, one of the first from New Orleans. He was a pilot, a major in the U.S. Army Air Force before the Air Force was a separate branch. And he was killed in North Africa. And that almost destroyed him. And I think that changed him completely. But I do think that, you know, he must have had self-doubt. He was a 17, 18, 19-year-old immigrant who was basically told to stop meddling. This is when he was 30, in Central America by the U.S. Secretary of State. I mean, how do you not have self-doubt? But I think to some extent he was like a bluffer. You know, my father used to say this thing, power is based on perception. If you think you got it, even if you don't got it.
Right.
And that was Zemuri. You know, you sort of are what you act like. And he was a big guy, you know, in an era when people weren't as big. He was like 6'3", and he was a big, tough guy. And unlike the other guys who ran banana companies who worked in offices, he was in the jungle in Honduras. He was out there clearing land and riding around on a mule. And that gave him incredible confidence. He felt like he really understood that business. And one of his favorite things to say when he dealt with, like, United Fruit in Boston was, you're there, I'm here.
Right.
But what's amazing is the United Fruit compound, it's like as if you cut a piece of America out and just pasted it in the jungle. They were inside the wire, you know, and they had a little schoolhouse, and they had a little village green, and they had a club, and they had a golf course. One really interesting thing was that in one of the United Fruit towns, one of the little kids beyond the wire was Gabriel Garcia Marquez.
Right. I love those literary connections you make in this
yeah.
book, too, to Marquez, as well as Pablo Neruda's poem about United Fruit.
Yeah.
So amazing.
United Fruit was more than a company. It had a whole sort of ideology, which is they saw themselves as these guys who went down into the jungle and tamed the jungle and brought wealth to places where there had never been wealth, because the jungle was always considered diseased, you know, and you couldn't mm-hmm. survive in the jungle. And they drained swamps, and they brought all this modern sanitation down there, and they planted stuff, and they got land very cheap because people didn't want that land. And they had this whole ideology that they were sort of the civilizers. And ultimately, they became so powerful that they had their own navy, they had their own army, they had 100,000 employees, and they were ultimately defeated, or at least the idea of them was defeated, by another story,
mm-hmm.
by the Gabriel Garcia Marquez story, and that's what survives, and United Fruit is gone.
So what drew you to him?
Part of it is that you have a certain sort of sanitized sense of history and how history happened, and it's very dull. It's often meetings, it's treaties, it's people in rooms. And I felt like in Zemuri, this is how history was really made. This is how America was really built. I mean, his life completely tracks the rise of America as a global power. He starts out in the 1890s, you know, and he winds up in 1961 dying just after the Bay of Pigs.
Right.
And United Fruit gave the ship and a lot of money for the Bay of Pigs. You know, they were completely involved in all that. And you sort of think that this is history. This is the real deal. This is how it really is. It's a giant Russian Jew on a mule riding through the jungle. I mean, that's how it's made.
Mm-hmm.
And you feel like in that you sort of see the truth. And that's what I think drew me to it.
Oh, of course. Now, you also say that the story of Sam Zamuri is the story of New Orleans. Tell me what you mean by that.
Well, I mean, I love New Orleans. I think it's the best city in America, most interesting city. But some things make me sad about New Orleans. I mean, when Zamuri was there, New Orleans was like maybe the number three city in America. And it had been, you know, the number one port. And that changed for all kinds of reasons. It's hard for people to understand Zamuri now because New Orleans isn't have the commerce at the level that it had then. And his life completely tracked the point where New Orleans was battling with Boston over which was going to be the big shipping city. And by the time that he died, it was already sort of over. It wasn't going to continue to be what it had been. And to me, sort of the story of all the energy he brings to New Orleans and what he built there is sort of what New Orleans maybe is missing a little bit of now.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's a big, big, wonderful story, and I think people are really going to love it. We've been talking with Rich Cohen, who's the author of The Fish That Ate the Whale, The Life and Times of America's Banana King. You can meet Rich Monday, June 4th at 6 p.m. at Octavia Books. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
It's time now for The Sound of Books with Fred Kasten. Today, the widely acclaimed new book from two-time Pulitzer Prize-winning author and journalist Steve Call, Private Empire, ExxonMobil, and American Power.
For Steve Call, the impetus for Private Empire flowed right out of his previous New York Times bestseller, The Bin Ladens.
My last book project was about Saudi Arabia and the Bin Laden family, and I was just interested in the story of how Osama bin Laden had been radicalized and the broader story of sort of social change and political change in Saudi Arabia. And when I came out of that project, I thought, you know, I really should write something about oil and American power in the world and how it's changing. And there was a book some years ago called The Prize by Dan Yergin that was a big sort of inspiration about how the oil industry expanded after the Second World War. And it was a story about big oil in the era of discovery. And I thought it was time to write something about big oil in an era of limits.
Steve Call settled on the story of ExxonMobil, from the Exxon Valdez oil spill in 1989 through the Deepwater Horizon catastrophe in 2010, and started to assemble and dig into a voluminous ExxonMobil paper trail.
All of the Securities and Exchange Commission filings, I filed Freedom of Information Act requests with the government and got lots of documents out of that, and then also all the different lawsuits that you can look at to try to learn about how things really work inside a company when otherwise the company might not want to talk about one aspect or another of its operations. A lot of records, a lot of reading, a lot of traveling.
He also did interviews, 450 of them, many with former ExxonMobil employees.
It's a company that's very closed. They don't invite much scrutiny. Their public relations strategy, they say themselves, is to say no comment in 50 different languages. They have a system of internal discipline that emphasizes that employees and managers should absolutely not talk to reporters without permission under any circumstances at pain of loss of retirement benefits and lots of other things. So, you know, they definitely hang together in that way. But, you know, people retire and people make their own decisions. It's a free country and not everybody's, intimidated by those kinds of rules. And you just have to keep knocking on doors. I would say that the refusal rate as a journalist, that is the number of people who say, I'm not going to help you, was higher in this case than in any I can think of. But that just means you have to knock on more doors to get the insights you want.
Steve Call discovered that one of ExxonMobil's biggest concerns is replenishing its reserves as it refines and sells oil and gas.
ExxonMobil produces 4.5 million barrels of oil equivalent oil and gas every day. And so you multiply that times 365 days, and you're talking about a lot of oil and gas you've got to find and replace each year. And the problem is the big pools of oil in the world, in the Middle East, are off limits to companies like ExxonMobil because of what is called resource nationalism, the view of the governments of those countries and their people that they just don't want foreign corporations to own their oil and gas. So if you can't get access to the big pools of safe, easy oil, then you end up being driven into these risky frontiers. On the one hand, they are entirely devoted every hour of every day to risk management. That's what their whole, you know, sort of operating system is about, and it's almost like a cult focused on risk management and really automating everything. And they've got a pretty good record since the Valdez, but not a perfect one. But I do think they're kidding themselves in the big picture about how much risk they're really taking on. They are being driven by their own business imperatives into more and more risky environments. The Arctic, drilling in incredibly harsh conditions, deep water offshore. Now, they'll tell you, look, we got it under control. We have systems to make sure we don't make any mistakes. But quite a lot of the environments where they're working are areas where it hasn't been done before. And there are human beings involved. And these are very complicated systems. And we see again and again when people tell us, oh, it can't happen, nuclear accident in Japan or the Valdez or Deepwater Horizon. You know, we know that human systems are fallible.
Steve Cull, author of the widely acclaimed and highly recommended new book, Private Empire, ExxonMobil and American Power. For 89.9 WWNO, I'm Fred Kasten.
Reading life never goes along without interruption. There are times when there is just no time to read, or times when you throw a disappointing book across a room or put it aside for a while. But these days, an entire city is being forced to consider a true disturbance in the force of its reading life. With the announcement that the Times-Picayune will go to a thrice-weekly print edition in the fall, readers are outraged, and rightly so. Probably our greatest reading loyalties in life are to our newspapers and our books of scripture, whatever those might be. They are great common threads in human life. Just as every home in New Orleans probably has some holy book on a shelf, I'd wager most families also have clippings from the Times-Picayune. Obituaries for sure, wedding announcements, treasured family recipes, sports sections trumpeting saints' victories, beloved carnival photos, and I'd be willing to bet that as many of those are on yellowing newsprint as are scanned on computer hard drives. A city's newspaper is its great community forum. Whether you agree or disagree with its coverage, you feel it is somehow yours, for better or worse, a newsprint kind of shotgun marriage. You know how you feel when you look over on the bus or in the coffee shop and see someone reading the Picayune. It's a sense of shared experience, common citizenship. Now 4 days a week, we will lose that sense of communal reading, that important tie that binds. So once again, as we're pushed to the computer screen for news, there's another loss. What does it mean that we lose the cherished reading object we hold in our hands? What does it mean that our children do not see us begin or end our days with a newspaper, modeling the importance not only of reading, but of civic engagement itself? We read a newspaper every kind of way, joyfully, critically, with amusement or fury, agreement or outrage. In our reactions to newspaper stories, we exemplify the best reading behavior, engaged and invested in the life of our hometown, and thinking for ourselves about what we read. It's a mistake to assume that in this city, most people get their news online. The digital divide here is real, deep, and wide. You have only to step into a public library to see that computers are not available to all our residents in their homes. We will have a less informed populace, and we will all be poorer for it in the long run. I'm not objective here, I confess. I worked for the Times-Picayune for more than 20 years. It's where I honed my craft of reading and writing about books, learned discipline, loved my coworkers, and took pride in the paper's great history, its grand achievements. And what I love most about the paper is that it was always great reading. And anytime there's less of that in the world, we all suffer. Here's what's on tap in the literary life this week. James W. Miller signs Where the Water Kept Rising, a college athletic director's fight to save a New Orleans sports institution. Thursday, May 31st at 5:30 at Garden District Bookshop. H.R. Hignauer is featured reader at 17 Poets Literary and Performance Series. Thursday, May 31st at 8 p.m. at the Goldmine Saloon. Maurice Ruffin and other members of the Melanated Writers Collective will read recent work at the New Orleans Museum of Art's Wary Art Series, Friday, June 1st at 7 p.m. at NOMA. Kalamu Yasalam host. The New Orleans Public Library kicks off its summer reading program with a party Saturday, June 2nd from 11 a.m. to 1 p.m. at Ladder Library. Come along to sign up, hear some music and great storytelling, and get ready for summer reading. Amy Elizabeth Smith signs All Roads Lead to Jane Austen, A Year-Long Journey with Jane, Saturday, June 2nd from 1 to 3 at Garden District Bookshop. Ace Atkins signs his new books, Lullaby, the latest in the Robert Parker Spencer series, and The Lost Ones, Sunday, June 3rd, 2:30 to 4:30 at Faulkner House Books. Bill Loefum signs the new paperback of his terrific thriller, The Devil She Knows, Tuesday, June 5th at 5:30 at Garden District Bookshop. The First Tuesday Book Club discusses Alexandra Styron's Reading My Father, a memoir, Tuesday, June 5th at 5:45 at Maple Street Bookshop on Maple Street. Today's guest, Rich Cohen, discusses and signs The Fish That Ate the Whale, The Life and Times of America's Banana King, Monday, June 4th at 6 p.m. at Octavia Books. In June, the New Orleans Museum of Art's Book Club will be reading the novel My Name is Red by Orhan Pamuk. It's about the murder of a 16th century Turkish master miniaturist and illuminator of books. Lisa Rotondo McCord, Assistant Director of Art and Curator of Asian Art, presents a program at noon Friday, June 8th, and the book club discussion of the novel takes place at noon Thursday, June 14th. Both meetings will be in the library at NOMA. And it's not too late to sign up to sponsor a writer in the 4th Annual Neighborhood Story Project's Write-A-Thon, June 10th at 1 o'clock. Writers, amateur and pro, come together to enjoy food from the joint and the cake cafe, writing and kibitzing and raising the money necessary to help the Neighborhood Story Project continue its mission, Our Stories Told by Us. The Story Project is now in its 8th year, past its 20th book, and is keeping up that mission. Check out Neighborhood Story Project's 4th Annual Write-A-Thon on Facebook for information. Major support for The Reading Life is provided by Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Christwood Retirement Community and the University of Louisiana at Lafayette Press. The Reading Life is produced by Jenny Lawson and is a production of WWNO. You can listen to us anytime or subscribe to our podcast at WWNO.org or email us at thereadinglife@WWNO.org. Thanks for listening and keep reading.